today. Instead it was me. Go down dramatically, stretching it out a bit.
Hello and welcome to the Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
It's true. We love books more than we love food.
That's probably not true for either of us. We love books so much that we are secretly characters in a book.
Yeah! We're actually compelled by the narrative to record this podcast every week.
That's right. So if we sound different from how we usually sound, it's not our fault. It's our writers. So anyway, I'm Ben.
I'm Gabs.
And I'm slightly more stuffed up than usual. You may have noticed.
Yeah, if you didn't notice, he sounds even more nasally than usual.
That's right. My head is full of fluids. It's disgusting.
I will reserve comment on that one. This week we are reading or talking about, I think we already read it, Red Shirts by John Scalzi.
Yes, one of my favorite authors, as it so happens.
Ben reads his blog.
Yes, religiously. He's one of the larger author internet presences out there.
Mm-hmm.
His blog is one of the older ones out there. Actually, I started reading it when I was still in college, so.
And back in the dark ages.
Yeah, I've been reading that blog for probably 10 years, and it's kind of terrifying to think that there's something I've been doing consistently for entertainment that for 10 years entirely after I was a legal adult.
Uh-oh. Yeah, 10 years ago, I was still but a child. Yeah, John Scalzi does have a pretty popular internet presence, and his books do well, at least to the science fiction community. Excuse me.
Yeah, they are fairly popular within that genre. They're kind of designed to be. I think Old Man's War actually made the list of the 100 top science fiction fantasy novels when they did their survey about that last year.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's some good reasons for that. I don't know if this book is actually most representative of his work.
Yeah, I mean, we chose the book because, again, we're doing... This is actually the last book in our bestsellers month.
It is also the book that has the most tenuous connection to being in bestsellers month. It did crack the New York Times list for a couple of weeks. I don't think it was especially high, and I don't think that it really stayed there, but at one point on his blog, I think he did mention that the first 2 weeks of this book's sales outsold Old Man's War for, like, the first 2 years.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting how the best seller book an author writes is not necessarily their best book or, like, the one you would recommend people read if you were a fan of the author.
Yeah, or in this case, even though it's probably the best-selling one, I'm not sure it's the one he's best known for, because Old Man's War, at least among science fiction fans these days, is pretty well known, especially since it spawned, three sequels and at least a handful of other stories parts of collections that are related to it. So, it's out there, for sure.
My theory is this book did so well because there are so many Star Trek nerds in the world.
It probably helps.
For anyone who is unfamiliar with the red shirt trope, and if you are, you're...
I don't know where you've been.
You're kind of a tool. But I'll explain it anyway. In Star Trek... When they land on a planet and go out on an away mission, the person always guaranteed to die is one of the new guys on the ship, one of the lower-ranking guys on the ship, because you can't kill off, Captain Kirk, and they're the ones who wear the red shirts.
Yeah, the security department wears red uniform shirts, so hence red shirts. And it's actually... So if, ask your local Trek nerd and they can fill you in on some of this, but it's like, oh, well, you're going to beam Kirk, Spock, and McCoy down to the planet with Ensign Jones. Guess who's going to get eaten by a Horta or stabbed by a Gorn?
Yeah.
Hint, not Captain Kirk.
Yeah. And red shirt is actually, like, now a synonymous term with, like expendable person who dies fast.
Mook or grunt or red shirt or...
Yeah.
Whatever your preferred terminology is.
It's entering the vernacular, so... The next time you watch a movie, you can... Roll red shirt!
Yeah, you're like, oh, those guys are just red shirts. They're doomed.
Yeah. Not related at all to football, so... No need to worry about that one.
Yeah, very different from that.
And this book definitely takes that red shirt trope and then just spends the entire plot playing up on it.
So. Yeah, it really just has a good time exploring, killing people off creatively. And
yeah.
Having an entire crew of a starship just being, like, paranoid lunatics because they've noticed this trend that someone always dies on an away mission.
Oh, we should mention, we haven't spoiled anything yet. But we do have a spoiler policy for the podcast.
Yeah, we'll spoil everything because we want to talk about everything, so we're not going to hold back just to spare your delicate feelings.
And I honestly don't really know how much there is to spoil about this book, because even though you know that they were, like, on a race to try and save themselves and all that stuff, being the type of book it was, you kind of knew it was all going to work.
Yeah, there's... I mean, I could argue there's nothing to spoil. I guess I could, you know, basically anything we could spoil, we would only be spoiling for someone who is pretty dense.
Yeah.
Because, frankly, if you don't predict everything that's going to happen in this book, then you're not really paying attention to it.
Yeah.
The mystery of the circumstances is not really what you're going to be reading it for.
Yeah. And that is one of the complaints I saw when I was briefly on the internet. Was that the book was predictable. And, I mean, part of my... I had some complaints about, like, the characterization and the plotting being predictable and stuff about the book. But at the same time, I think Scalzi could turn it around and say that's kind of part of the point of the book, is to be predictable and have characterization the way he wrote it and all that, so...
Yeah, I mean, it would... certainly fit with the idea, with the concept of the book, really. Just, well, yeah, no one is all that deeply characterized. Like, they're extras.
Yeah, they're all red shirts. No one gives a shit.
Not to mention, it's a really short book.
Yeah. We looked that up. It's 55,000 words.
Plus 3 codas.
Mm-hmm. And for anyone who's unaware... 55,000 words is, like, more novella than novel length.
Yeah, usually I think 60 is even 60,000 words is considered the threshold for a commercial novel.
Yeah.
And so tacking the codas on the end probably helped keep the publishers happy, though. Scalzi, at this point, has enough of a name that he would have been okay at 55 anyway.
Gotten away with it. But then I would have been sad without the codas.
That's true. Codas were probably the best, from a writing standpoint, the codas were the best part of the book, I'd say.
Well, I guess we've already kind of given the plot synopsis, but since we always like to give the plot synopsis, let's go ahead and do that.
Basically everybody dies due to bad writing.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's one of the actually major themes of the book is, bad writing equals killing characters, like, senselessly.
Right.
You know, they talk about, if I was dying for a purpose, I wouldn't really care, but, you know, I'm getting eaten by an ice shark. What the fuck is that?
What is an ice shark? Is it a shark made out of ice? Is it a shark that lives in the ice?
Is it a shark that survives on ice? These are questions we need to know. It does give us the chance to say that the protagonist of the story is Andy Dahl. Or is it?
Or is it? And also, in this story, protagonist has an extra layer of meaning, perhaps.
Yeah, this book, I'm sure to Ben's everlasting joy, is extremely meta.
It's so meta.
Because you have the main characters that you're following, who are technically extras to protagonists of, you know, the ship, like the captain, etc., they might be on a television show where they're just extras. Also, they managed to get to the real world and do stuff and influence the show that way, and then at the end, maybe they're actually on a show where they are the protagonists who think that they're on a show where they're not the protagonists
who go back in time to save themselves.
To the fictional real present to save themselves.
Layers within layers. It's amazing.
Yo, dog, I heard you like Star Trek. So I put Star Trek in your Star Trek.
So you can star in your own Trek.
Yeah, I guess we should mention that the book is not technically, or the plot the characters are in is not technically Star Trek, but it's so obviously based off of Star Trek.
Star Trek is referenced, and then the show that they're in is clearly like a shitty ripoff of Star Trek.
Yeah, yeah.
The Adventures of the Intrepid, or what was
the title of the show? Something like Chronicles of the Intrepid.
Chronicles of the Intrepid.
Yeah. But let's talk a little bit about the characters. Again, like we said, there's not a lot to talk about with most of them.
Yeah, well, let's start with Andy Dahl, because he's supposedly the protagonist.
Yeah.
And
you follow him around for most of the book.
Yeah, and actually, we're just about done talking about him already. Like, he's mildly smart-assed. Actually, one of the hallmarks of a Scalzi novel is that almost all of the characters are at least mildly smart-assed.
Yeah.
They can't help themselves. And he is curious about his circumstances, and he cares about his friends, and that's about it. Which is about as generic as you can be.
Yeah. Yeah, like, the fact that he's smart-ass would stand out more if all the other characters weren't equally smart-ass.
Yeah, I mean, the dialogue is probably 80% banter.
Yeah, yeah. We have his buddy, Jimmy Hansen.
Who appears briefly in the introduction and then is, like, present at everything, but doesn't really ever do it.
He talks occasionally, but that's about it.
Yeah, he actually shows up again at the very end in yet another layer of self-reference.
Yeah.
As Dahl says, wait a minute, shouldn't I have been dead like three times over? How come we don't, how come you haven't been part of any of these away missions? Where have you been all this time? Oh, wait a minute. You're supposed to be the protagonist's buddy who points out to him that he's the protagonist in the show about him figuring out that he's the protagonist of a show where he thought he wasn't the protagonist of the show, and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. And then he's just kind of like, see you at dinner.
He's like, oh, well, maybe that's true, but if it is, I guess I just did it, so see ya.
We have Duval, who is our token female character. I mean, there are other female characters, but she's the main female character.
Yeah, there are, you know, I'll give a little bit of credit for the blend of the crew, because there were usually women, and with all the throwaway names, there was always a woman or two in each scene, right? But yeah, as far as characters who get dialogue and such, she was about it.
Yeah, and I was kind of wondering before we started if, you know, this is just another example of a guy writer not really including a lot of female characters, or if it's, and again, I don't know if this is me reading too much into it, but if it's supposed to be a commentary on the fact that, like, on a show like Star Trek, you know, you have Kirk, Spock, McCoy, Russian guy, Scotty, and then you have, like, Uhura.
Right.
And so, you know, is he including Duval as our token female character, as saying, like, well, you know, these types of shows usually only have one female important female character running around.
I think it's possible that it's a commentary. I think it's possible that there was not that much thought that went into it as well. The third coda helps.
Yeah.
I will say that based on having read, well, nearly everything else he's published, that he's written a couple of books from the perspective of women, so this isn't an author who struggles to put himself in that headspace, necessarily.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, it would be, actually, it might be interesting to find out.
Yeah, that's something I would like to ask. You know, and it didn't necessarily piss me off, because the novel's kind of fluffy anyway. It's not, like, something I got super hung up on, but it is something I noticed, because, you know, I make it a point to notice those things.
Right.
Okay, let's see. Who do we have to round out the red shirts?
Hester.
Hester, who can pilot a...
He can pilot a shuttlecraft. And his name is Jasper.
His name is Jasper Allen. And
Finn.
Finn, the drug dealer.
The drug dealer, yep.
Slash skeptic. Slash casualty.
Yep.
He is actually the one main character who gets killed off.
Yeah, in like a really weirdly self-sacrificing way.
Yeah.
Because he, it looks like Duvall is going to get dragged off on one of these away missions that's related to her backstory, which means she's doomed.
Yeah.
And so he prevents her from going on the mission, and then it turns out he gets weaved into the backstory.
Yeah.
And then dies via exploding head. Not his.
Yeah. Bomb in other guy's head. It's pretty questionable.
Yes, as predicted, people would die frequently and comically in this book.
Yeah. Finn was the one death, or like one of the moments in the book that actually did surprise me, because I kind of guessed that like that entire group was just going to make it through, and then when Finn died, I did go, oh, I wonder if one or two more of them might die. But he was kind of the catalyst necessary for them to realize that they actually were in a science fiction show with shitty writing.
Yeah, because prior to his death, I was actually trying to figure out, because on one hand I was thinking, similarly to what you were, where, oh, well, this whole crew of folks we've been introduced to will make it to the end, and somehow, whatever wackiness ensues. But then I also had the thought for a while that, well, maybe they're all just going to get killed off. Like,
yeah.
One by one in ridiculous ways, but because they're trapped in this narrative, they can't do anything about it.
Uh-huh.
But then once they have the idea to go back in time, it's like, oh, okay, that's how they're going to do it.
Yeah.
Oh, now I get it.
And I had that idea, too. I was like, couldn't they just go back in time and get them to stop writing the show? And they did it! And I was like, oh, yeah.
All right.
Those are all kind of like the main red shirt characters. The main character?
The protagonists of the Chronicles of Intrepid.
Yes. The big one we get to know is Lieutenant Kerensky.
The Astrogator. He's the Chekhov character. That's the Russian
Chekhov.
Guy.
Chekhov. Thank you.
To help you out a little bit there.
Gee.
But he always ends up going on these away missions, despite the fact he's an astrogator. He's a navigator, okay,
yeah.
Guys? He's the guy who knows how to run the fancy 23rd century GPS, or whatever you call it. Galactic positioning system. How's that?
Yeah.
Nice.
Solid.
But he keeps getting sent to, like, the space station full of killer robots, or the frozen world with ice sharks, or to go explore the ruins of a colony that's been attacked by weird aliens. And
yeah.
He's like, I just want to get the ship from point A to point B. I'm really good at it. And I don't want to go on the away missions, but every time they tell me I'm going on one, I'm like, oh yeah, that's a good idea, but I don't know why.
Yeah. Leaves him to get shot or get the plague or whatever.
Right.
Beams spear his liver and all.
He's
that.
Always injured, like getting shot or poisoned or whatever, and recovers in a ridiculously short time.
Yeah, in the 23rd hour.
Because they have to have. Because a week later, they have to have him going on another away mission.
Yeah.
Because that's how the show works. He is maybe
I think he's actually one of the deeper characters in the book.
Yeah. And maybe the funniest character in the book.
He's pretty funny.
Because he's, like, has this really in kind of endearing combination of character traits where on one hand he's, like, really cluelessly self-absorbed.
Uh-huh.
But then on the other hand he has this really confused self-awareness to some degree at least.
Mm-hmm.
Where he's, like I was just talking about with the, but why do I keep having to go on this? But then he seems to be wandering around in a mental fog the rest of the time. Where, what's going on? Why don't I have pants?
Yeah, why don't I? And then when he meets his doppelganger, and there's a whole confusion over what happened between them. That was pretty funny.
Have you ever just really connected with someone?
They're like, oh, God.
They're like, oh, God, you fucked each other, didn't you?
No!
What is wrong with you people?
So pissed.
Is this, like, an amazing conversation?
Or at the end, he's just piloting, like, insanely, like, if we're gonna live, we're gonna live, whatever.
That's right. If it's a narrative, let's see how this works. Let's see what those writers think of my piloting skills.
Yeah, Kerensky was pretty good. Jenkins was the other crew character that had some depth to him.
Yeah, he was the guy who figured out that this narrative was kicking in.
Uh-huh.
He was stricken by the death of his wife.
Who was killed off for...
Who was killed off senselessly.
Yeah.
And he's been hiding in the bowels of the ship, apparently for years now.
Yeah.
It seems like he just
tried. Not shaving.
Get off the ship.
Yeah.
Simpler way, dude. But he's been gathering evidence and observations and has kind of come around on what's going on. He's the one who presents the crazy theory of, oh, we're actually trapped on a shitty science fiction show. Look, here, guys, look at this. There was this old show called Star Trek. Okay, and then later there was this other show that clearly ripped it off, except it was way worse, called The Chronicles of the Intrepid.
I think it's evidence of, you know, the closest ship matching our mortality rate is the Enterprise.
Right? And, like, the captain had this previous reputation, and look how all these things have changed since he got here, and notice how physics stops working properly in the middle of battles.
I did like that scene where Andy was like checking everything off, you know, like something on the deck has to explode because, or the bridge has to explode because, you know, we're watching the bridge and it's always decks 6 through 12 that catch on fire. Right. And
decks 6 through 12 take damage because that's what they have sets of and it's cheaper.
Yeah, and they just cut to a shot of it exploding. Then this is gonna happen. And it all does. And then it's also, you know, funny because that kind of shit happens on those kinds of shows.
Oh, totally. Like, yeah, anyone who's seen more than about 3 episodes of Star Trek definitely recognizes all of those tropes. Oh, they're gonna take damage usually in specific deck numbers, and they'll cut to this, and then a console on the bridge will blow up, and someone will say, brace for impact, and yet nobody has seat belts.
Yeah.
Even though it's apparently a thing.
Yeah.
Like, they'll be mapping a black hole where the gravitic forces are ridiculous and there's no problem with the gravity on the ship. But then they get into battle and do some combat maneuver that, yes, while strenuous, is not hardly a black hole. And all of a sudden people are, like, flying across the deck.
What happened to the inertial dampeners? No one knows.
Like, the captain will kick into this really heroic mode of speech whenever there's a big crisis moment that'll end, and he'll be confused.
He's yeah.
Like, what's going on? Like, why is that console exploding? What's wrong with my bridge?
Imagine the engineer, like, bursts in to tell him something's going on, and the narrative breaks, and then they're all kind of like...
staying around awkwardly.
And the captain's like, I guess go fix that then. And the engineer's like, why didn't I just call you?
Yeah, why did I walk up to the bridge instead of fixing it to begin with?
I'm so confused. Those are pretty good moments. And that's like where a lot of the humor comes from, is either like playing off of Star Trek tropes or characters like pointing them out and being like, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah, it's usually like the really I mean, because you have to be more of a fan of that show, that those shows and that genre of show, to get a lot of the in-jokes, I think. But then the fourth wall kind of moments are what really make it work for anybody. Though, again, I do find it difficult to imagine that anyone purchasing and reading the novel Red Shirts has not seen a fair amount of Star Trek.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm definitely not the biggest Star Trek fan in the world and haven't seen a lot of it by a lot of people's standards, but I've seen enough to...
Right.
You know, I had to watch enough of it when I was younger because of you, but I know more or less what's going on. We've already kind of brought it up, but there's not a huge amount of depth to the book. You know, there's the meta-commentary and, like, the little jokes flying around. But there is actually, like, a theme kind of running throughout that gets played up more in the codas, which we'll talk about in just a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this, they keep talking about how, you know, like, or I said, you know, we wouldn't mind dying if we died for a reason.
Right.
But the reason they're dying is just to create quick, cheap drama.
Right, before the commercial break.
Yeah, like in the opening when the guy dies because his father is friends with the captain and they know that'll create this big plot line, dramatic plot line for the captain.
Right.
But, like, that's all we know about him is, like, his dad is friends with the captain.
Right.
And so it's this commentary on, like, hey, stop making cheap deaths to create drama. That's just shitty writing.
Yeah, and then some of the things we've already talked about is other examples of why that writing is bad. But unlike most characters trapped in a show with bad writing, these characters get to go back and talk to the writer.
Yeah, and be like, fucking stop it, dude.
Which was a pretty good scene, actually, them confronting the head writer of the show and him kind of, well, being a little defensive at first, and then as the conversation goes on, kind of acknowledging, like, yeah, we're actually pretty lame, like, I'm sorry.
Yes, yeah, sucks. My bad.
Except for the thing with the worms, which he was really defensive about, because that one wasn't his.
He was sick. One of the other writers is obsessed with Dune.
Obsessed with Dune.
Couldn't do
anything. He did create some sandworms to eat one of the crewmen.
I did actually want to say, though, that, like, this bad writing equals death thing, because I know John Scalzi, like, also, in addition to being an experienced writer who obviously writes a lot, is a good person to give advice to people who are aspiring young writers.
Has written many pieces of advice about writing, yeah. Both and online and in a book form.
It is totally a tendency of beginning authors to try and create drama cheaply.
Right.
Not saying that I'm, you know, a good author, but I took creative writing classes in college, and the difference between beginning fiction and advanced fiction was pretty stark, because in beginning fiction, it's like, oh, everyone has to write a story and create drama, and you just had, like, the same three plots happening over and over again, like, this character dies, this character's getting abused, this character... And it happened in my intermediate class, too. We had to do, like, a, write a story from the point of view of, blah, I don't remember exactly what it was. And people were writing, like, death and torture. And my story was, like, about a little girl wanting to go to the pool with her brother. And I was like, this is kind of awkward. Like, it has nothing to do with anyone else's stories.
This isn't death, abuse, or a horrible breakup.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, I mean, it's still in advanced fiction for sure, but then in advanced fiction you actually get people who, like, you know, who have written it and stuff, and you get plots that are actually, like, interesting.
Right. And you know, we could have talked about this a little bit last week.
Yeah.
I guess we kind of did. The whole, the cancer's in there, but it's not like...
It's not the source of the drama
necessarily.
Yeah. And so that's, like, part of what's going on here is, like, oh, I need to create drama. Kill someone. Or I need to create drama. Abuse! Or whatever. I mean, I look at some of my old stuff and cringe, so...
You'd slow down if your character showed up and confronted you about it. Dude, stop killing us!
Yeah, I know, I was thinking about that, like... I was thinking about what Gurm would do if he had to go back and look at all the characters he killed. and see if he could, like, justify each death.
Does he kill... Does he kill characters cheaply?
Well, I mean, they kind of die by the hundreds in some situations.
He just does it so casually. I don't think he's doing it to create drama.
He's just like, whatever. Another character did. Their lives are worthless to me. But I kind of like that, like, message tucked in there, and that actually is good advice to aspiring writers. Like, stop killing characters just to make drama, guys.
Right. Figure... You can figure something out that's dramatic. That doesn't require to kill someone off.
Yeah.
And that doesn't require to use ice sharks.
Yeah.
Which they were really hung up on.
Yeah. Or the killer robots. I liked those.
Or the killer robots, yeah. Especially because there were different kinds. They're like, killer robots. And that one has a harpoon? What the hell? And like a little swarm of tiny...
Yeah, the swarm.
Dude! Like, you're not even consistent within your one moronic storyline.
All different kinds of killer robots. Do you want to talk about the codas a little bit?
Yeah, let's. So... There are three codas. Actually, the novel describes itself as a short novel with three codas. Uh-huh. So there you go.
I actually didn't know that, and then I hit the end of the plot, and I went, oh, okay, codas.
Yeah, and I actually had no idea what to expect from the codas. I was kind of expecting short stories with the characters.
Uh-huh.
And that's not at all what it was.
No, it's like... The book itself is about the characters on the show, in a show or whatever, and then the codas are about, like, the people on present-day Earth timeline.
Yeah, and so the first coda is the head writer of the show, who is basically...
Losing his mind.
Kind of losing his mind. Like, he's this really horrible writer's block, so it's him blogging about meeting his characters he's been creating and killing and having confronted them, and... trying to get help from the internet, because that's always a good idea.
Yeah, I actually liked that, because it seemed like something that actually would happen.
Yeah, it kind of
did. And if you are a writer and you meet your characters in real life, like, who are you going to go to with that problem? The internet. People on the internet are going to believe you.
That's, I guess that's...
Like...
They're going to believe you more than anybody else
would. Yeah, exactly.
Let's ask the trolls on the internet. What's the worst, like, what's the worst that can happen?
That's better than trying to talk to, like, people in real life. Just saying.
Right. The people in real life might try to lock you up or something.
Yeah.
Like, on the internet, the worst they're going to do is call you a fag and tell you to kill yourself.
Right. In all caps. Oh, internet. Yeah. That's the first coda, and it's his personal blog trying to, like, get over his writer's block, basically.
It's pretty silly. It's pretty...
Yeah.
It's almost, like, cutesy, almost.
Yeah.
But...
It's very much in the same tone as...
Mm-hmm, yeah.
...the novel.
Which, maybe that's because he was writing all those characters.
More meta quotes.
But no, he figures it out. He gets over his writer's block, and... I mean, you get a couple insights into the character, because he's not entirely bearing his soul, because there is a lot of snark in the way he phrases things, but he's legitimately struggling with something, and you get to see more of his thoughts than you do of probably Andy Dahl's.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But Codas 2 and 3, the ones that really surprised me. I finished reading the second one, got a little choked up, read the third one, got a little choked up again, and I was like, what the hell? Like, goofy novel, completely goofy coda one, and then, like, pretty poignant little short stories.
Yeah, they were actually really good. like we said earlier, you know, as far as just from a writing standpoint, the second and third coda, probably the best parts of the book.
Yeah, I was saying earlier that, like, the book was cute. But I honestly, like, the codas helped make it more worth it to me. I think I would have been more critical, like, a little more about it if those codas hadn't happened. And I ended on such, like, a, yeah, no. And the thing I liked about the second coda is that, because you kind of have, like, a real-life typical drama situation going on with, like, the producer's kid got into a motorcycle accident and is in the hospital in a coma, and part of the thing the characters do is you know, get him out of his coma by him and Hester switching bodies and all this junk. And the code is in the aftermath of all of that and, like, takes this kind of wacky scenario and, like, actually makes it...
Makes it realistic, I guess.
Yeah.
He's going, wait, so I was out. Like, there was the accident and then there was all of this sick time, apparently, and then all of a sudden, like, I'm on my feet and perfectly healthy, and I have no idea how it happened.
Yeah, he's, like, trying to sleuth it out.
And then, yeah, and then he gets himself checked out at the doctor's office, and there's no sign of any of the injuries.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, he's just, he's really struggling with it. Like, it's really tearing him apart to some degree. And he's... It really is just all this confusion and kind of depression, really.
But then I liked how you had this, like, almost like a 20-somethings. Maybe that's why I liked it so much, just because that part of it spoke to me, but it's like trying to figure out what the fuck he wants to do with his life.
Yeah, that was a big part of it.
Conclusion and trying to figure that out and...
So I guess the acting thing is over. That was the thing I thought I wanted to do. Just like the last six things I thought I wanted to do. I don't know what I want to do. And I can certainly sympathize with that.
Yeah. No kidding. And then Coda 3 follows Samantha Martinez.
Yes, who is the actress who played Jenkins' wife.
And in the actual body of the book, Andy Dahl drops off all these letters and videos and stuff between Jenkins and his wife that he sent to her. Because he's kind of, you know, letting go. And that's, like, the end of it. You're kind of like, oh, okay. And then, like, Coda 3 actually, you know, plays that out. So you get to see, like... what she did with the notes and, like, what it meant to her and, like, how it's helping change and shape her life. And...
Right. Yeah, I actually thought that the third coda was really interesting because I was kind of throwing around this idea in my head of, well, if I got all this stuff all of a sudden of someone who looks just like me, who is me... To a degree. And I see them, like, living this alternate life. Like, would that have meaning to me?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that would be meaningful to every person.
Yeah.
But it certainly was to this woman.
Mm-hmm. And it kind of had one of the elements it had that I liked, which is present in some of the other stuff we've read, is this, like, short meetings with various characters, and she doesn't really stick with them for too long, but, like, in their conversation, you get a lot about them.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the date she had with the widower, talking about, like, his experience, or, like, meeting her friend who's now a Catholic priest, and, like, their short conversation.
Right.
And how those short conversations are, like, really good, and you get a lot from the characters, and they just kind of move on. It's just, like, you know, that, like, couple pages that are...
Yeah.
And I like the style of writing when you just get, like, a bunch of character and meaning in a couple pages, and it just kind of goes...
Yeah, I like that, too. And those always feel, you know, kind of vaguely script-like to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that's... I mean, in a book, it can be really effective, especially in a short story. Because in a novel, obviously, you usually have a lot of time to play around. But in a short story, not so much. In a movie, every second of screen time... is valuable. It's expensive.
Yeah, well, you know.
And so really good screenwriters are really good at having those short conversations, you know, 60 seconds, 2 minutes, where you just get a lot out of it.
It's kind of, I guess I would equate it more to playwriting than screenwriting.
It's the same principle.
Yeah, it is. Because I was just thinking of the movie Moonstruck, which does that really well, but that movie was written by a playwright. Who also did a play that does that very well.
It's a similar principle, I should say, because in a play, you do have to be getting something out of a character every time they're on stage.
Yeah.
In a movie, ideally, you are as well, but then in a lot of movies, if you run out of ideas for how to draw things out of the character, you just blow something up.
Yeah. But you did specify good screenwriting.
That's true. A Michael Bay movie might...
We are not talking about that.
...be the kind of thing where the characters would come back and bitch at him.
But yeah, and then Coda 3 kind of ends on a note that could be cheesy, but actually didn't come across as cheesy to me.
Oh, where she ran into this
actor who played Jenkins.
Right.
Or well, the screenwriter. Yeah, my bad. And they kind of have a connection and go off, and it's like, oh, like, Jenkins and his wife maybe kind of get their lives recreated to some degree, but it's not, like, presented as, like, a, we love each other, let's be together
right,
forever.
Right, it's like a, oh, you're interesting, let's go have some lunch.
Yeah. And, yeah, I just really liked it. That's...
Hey, that's fair.
Like, the novel was a fun, quick read. I got through it fast. I enjoyed it. Like you said earlier, it's probably a good thing it wasn't too much longer than it was.
Yeah, if it was a longer story, say if it had been a 100,000-word novel instead of a 55,000-word novel, like, holy cow, almost double the length.
Yeah.
Then... I think, I'm confident it would have been structured differently, actually, because John Scalzi is a professional writer. I mean, he writes it on his blog all the time, like, how being a professional writer is different from being someone who writes stuff sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, he understands how those things work. But, yeah, for a longer story, you would want way more characterization from these people. You would need more, like... For this length of story, it was perfect because you're really just trying to... It's really an extended joke.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Is what it is. And so we don't have to care deeply about Andy Dahl.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to care deeply about Lieutenant Kerensky.
No.
We just kind of have to know them a little bit.
And kind of know their purpose and...
Yeah, and if, you know, they're a little goofy from time to time to help keep the joke funny... Good.
Like, yeah.
That's all it needs.
Yeah. But it's definitely not, you know, I think, Ben, you were saying that, you know, it's cute, but it's not Scalzi's best work.
I agree, actually. Yeah. I talked about Old Man's War already, and actually my favorite book of his is Zoe's Tale, which is the third book in the Old Man's War trilogy retold through the eyes of the teenaged daughter. It's really good. And it's... Actually, I almost referenced it last week because...
A guy was another, writing it.
There's another, like, 40-year-old male author. Well, I don't know if John Green is 40. Hopefully I didn't just insult John Green. But it's another adult male author writing a teenage girl and having her come across as really believable.
Yeah. I haven't read Zoe's War, but... I've heard good things.
Mostly from me, probably.
Yeah. So, yeah, context relevance, like we've already said a bunch, is the Star Trek joke. If you are a fan of Star Trek and kind of want to read, you know, something meta and, like, little references here and there you can point to and giggle at, but, like, for sure pick up the book.
Or if you just don't have the time for Gurm and you don't want to cry and read The Fault in Our Stars.
Yeah.
You just want a cute book to read that will definitely entertain you, assuming that you are at least passingly familiar with science fiction tropes.
Yeah.
You absolutely enjoy this book.
And if you want to read some sci-fi and you're like, well, I don't know if I want something that fluffy, then, you know, pick up Old Man's War, any of the stuff Ben's been talking about that John Scalzi is
in. Yeah, there you go.
So, questions for the book?
I kind of, you know, since we were talking about it now, I kind of do want to know what Nice Shark is.
Yeah, I was going to say, I want to know about the female character thing.
Yeah. And, you know, for that matter, I wouldn't mind having the existential questions answered, though I guess it's kind of implied that the show ends and the characters keep existing if they lived happily ever after.
Yeah. They all died. Now I'm just fucking
with you. Now I'm just fucking with you. They're fine.
They're okay. Yeah. So we liked it, obviously, but, you know.
I enjoyed it for what it is.
I was going to say, like, in a battle between The Fault in Our Stars and Red Shirts, which, two totally different books, it's, like, not even fair to compare them.
Right.
Like, obviously, The Fart... Jesus Christ. The Fart in Our Stars!
The Fart in Our Stalls. The Bathroom Parody.
That would be a very, very different book. The Fart in Our Stalls. Oh, my God. It's a book about pooping.
The tale of a teenage girl with cancer who poops uncontrollably.
Jesus Christ. I've just ruined everything forever. Okay, well, comparing the two, The Fault in Our Stars is much more, you know, literary, meaningful, deep kind of thing. But Red Shirts is still a fun read, so.
Yeah, well, if it was a battle between the two, then The Fault in Our Stars wins by a lot.
Yeah. But, you know, we can't...
No offense to Mr. Scalzi, but...
We can't dwell on that too much, or else for, like, the next 4 months, we'll just be like, yeah, it's No Fault in Our Stars. Yeah,
it's honestly going to be very difficult to come across another book that is as impactful emotionally immediately.
To our entire family.
Yeah, exactly.
In the span of, like, 2 weeks. So, what are you reading right now?
I'm reading White Knight, which is, of course, another book in the Dresden Files. And I just finished Proven Guilty, which is the book in the Dresden Files before that, but after whatever the last one was I mentioned on the air. So, obviously I'm going to be reading those until I'm done with them. I think that's pretty obvious.
What? I started reading Insurgent this week by Veronica Roth, which is the sequel to Divergent, which you'll recall maybe we read about a month ago and podcasted. And I will say it's getting some questions answered.
I may or may not borrow that from you.
Depending on, per my recommendation.
Yes.
So, if you would like to talk to us at all, you can leave a comment on our website at novelideaspodcast.com.
We remembered the name of our own website this week.
Jesus
Christ. We struggled a little down the stretch there. Or you can email us, novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
You can find us on Twitter at novelideaspod.
And you can leave a comment on iTunes, because you can listen to us on iTunes. Leave us ratings, reviews, whatever you can do on iTunes, because I actually have no idea how that works, because I don't use iTunes.
I check it out.
But do that, because I gather they feature people if they get enough attention. It probably helps if you have more than a dozen listeners, but
hey, whatever.
You know. And so next week...
Next week, we are moving out of bestseller mode, although this is kind of a bestseller-y classic, I guess.
It's definitely a classic. You know, we like to hit our classics. This is another one of those where we're going to start at the beginning of the podcast and say, if you ever went to a day of school, they made you read this. They sat you down in the afternoon and they're like, you read this, and then you get to go home.
Yeah.
And then, like, half of my friends are going to go, I never had to read that in school.
And then you're going to punch them all in the face. I know, I'm going to be pissed. So for any of you who haven't read To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee, go die in a fire. Or, you know, read To Kill a Mockingbird. I've
read the South of the Border parody, Tequila Mockingbird.
Jesus. Stop listening to that, please. Like we said, super duper classic. Everyone reads it in school. There's the movie out, which people love. Et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, plus there's a dude named Atticus.
Yeah.
Which How badass is that?
Fucking awesome. I want to name my next dog Atticus.
That'd be a great dog name.
Yeah. And everyone's going to steal it.
Oh, man. Yeah, especially when we start our new podcast, Bitchin' Things to Name Your Dog.
Only after we finish the Sean Bean versus Bill Paxton podcast.
Well, actually, the next two dogs I have are going to be Sean Bean and Bill Paxton.
we can slip, we can make the two podcasts one.
And then you'll have Atticus, and then I'll have Tequila Mockingbird.
Okay. This is just singing into insanity.
That's what happens when we record this late.
So I guess that's all from us for this week.
Yeah, I guess it is. So we'll see you next time.